My name is Arup Chakrabarty, folks. I work at PagerDuty, where I'm one of our directors of engineering. I get to work with our infrastructure engineering teams, which involves SRE, hence why I'm here. I also have my Twitter handle up here, so if you do have feedback, questions, thought-provoking ideas throughout the talk, please feel free to use the interwebs to get a hold of me. That said, I'm also going to take off my watch now so I'm not distracted by your angry tweets. Before I jump in, a couple of disclaimers that I always like to give at talks. First is, I work with a lot of smart people, and by saying that, I'm not the one who came up with all the ideas that I'm going to be talking about today. I'm very, 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 very lucky to work with some brilliant engineers and brilliant managers at my company, and I'm up here talking about a lot of these ideas and concepts, but I did not invent all of them, and don't want to pretend that I did. A lot of these ideas and concepts are the results of thousands of failed experiments and things that we've learned over the last couple of years at PagerDuty. The next is, you are not PagerDuty. One thing that I can get away with at PagerDuty, especially around reliability, it's kind of what we do. It's very ingrained in our culture, even from the beginning. And the last thing I want anyone in this audience to do is go back to their organizations and say, hey, PagerDuty does it this way, we should do it that way. Because here's what usually happens. Your boss then sends my boss an angry email saying, hey, your stupid direct told my direct to do this, cut it out. Instead, what I'd like all of you as leaders to do is take this information, take this content, digest it, think about it over the weekend, and then on Monday, think about what's relevant to you. Think about what's relevant and apply the context that you have within your organizations to fix the problems that you might be facing in your orgs. Slides will be posted after the talk as well, so don't worry if you don't record everything. And then lastly, we get this wrong too. Like I said earlier, a lot of the stuff I'm gonna be talking about is the results of a lot of failed experiments, a lot of mistakes that we made internally ourselves, and we just got better. And what worked for us 12 months ago doesn't work for us today, and definitely won't work for us 12 months from now. And so I really wanna remind everyone here that this is always a work in progress for us, and this isn't something that's static or something that we think we've gotten right and we're done. Nope, we are always working on our culture, always working on how we think about reliability at our company. All right, so some definitions so all of us can get on the same page. First, reliability. Here's kind of the textbook definition, the probability that your software works. I have an asterisk there because the definition of works depends on your business. And we typically think of this as a number of nines, right? Oh, we are 3, 4, 5 nines of availability. Again, probability, that's what you're measuring there. A slightly more cynical way of thinking about this, it's kind of what every CTO claims they want because numbers. Technical leaders tend to really like measurements and numbers, and they hear this thing called reliability. Yeah, we should absolutely fix that, and we really need 10 nines, right? That's what every business needs. And the reason they gravitate towards this is because, again, because that metrics and measurements nature of reliability and availability, and then they find out how much it costs. My rough rule of thumb is if it takes you, whatever it takes you to get to X nines of availability, to get to X plus one nines of availability, it costs an order of magnitude more. So if you spend 100 euro to get to 2 nines of availability, it's gonna cost you 1,000 euro to get to 3 nines of availability or reliability. Next, culture. So again, textbook definition, social behavior and norms for a group of people. If you look at Wikipedia, you're gonna see something like this. I like to think about it as a way to get your colleagues to behave the way you want them to without staring at them all the time. culture is one of these weird kind of squishy things. It sometimes can be hard to articulate, but kind of the way that I've thought about this over the years, it's that it's a very powerful way to influence the thousands of micro decisions that all of your individuals make at your company throughout every day. It's the engineer sitting at their desk deciding, hey, should I write this to have some retry logic or not? We care about reliability. Okay, I'm gonna put in some retry logic there. And that's culture right there. You're influencing that micro decision without having to circle back and up the chain constantly for what should an engineer be doing with all these decisions. So the first tactic that I really like using when I think about influencing the culture around reliability is making sure we have the right metrics in place. Now I'm sure some of you have had this kind of a conversation after an outage where your boss says, can you show me the business impact? You know, it's a fairly reasonable ask, right? Outage, show me the business impact. And you know, I've been the frustrated engineer here. Oh, here's a graph of open file descriptors going through the roof. Servers and systems crash and outage. what the hell is a file descriptor is usually what your manager is going to respond to that with. And the reason for this is because the number of open file descriptors is not something your manager cares about. So one way to think about kind of what metrics should you be measuring and presenting back to your management, leadership, and other folks in your company are business metrics that managers care about. But I'll be perfectly frank with each of you. This doesn't get me excited in the morning. I work well with my own manager, but I don't get excited about things that he only cares about. What I do get excited about, though, are metrics that customers care about. I care much more about what my customers are and how they're interacting with my service versus purely what my manager or my exec team cares about for our business. And usually there's a lot of good alignment here. If it's something your customers care about, chances are your exec team and your management team also cares about it as well. So to kind of help folks distill how to get these metrics in and where to kind of look for them, I'm going to divide all online businesses into kind of two categories of business. First is individual transaction businesses, and the second is subscription businesses. And I'm purposefully oversimplifying here. There's a lot of nuance to both of these, but I'm trying to keep it as simple as possible to kind of give you folks a framework on what kind of metrics to look for as you try to find these metrics. So, when I talk about an individual transaction business, I'm talking about this idea that every time a customer uses your service, the business makes money. So a good example of this, e-commerce. You go to a website, you add to cart, you click the buy button, the business makes money, the customer's paying it. If you're, say, an online ads marketplace, each time that a customer views an ad, you are making money from the person buying the ad. Subscription business is the idea that it's every time that a customer interacts with your service, they might not be necessarily paying money, but you're going to be receiving money on a consistent basis. So a lot of SaaS tools in general, you get billed at the end of the month, and every time you use it, you don't really have to think about the credit card or anything like that. You just keep using it, resting assured that, yep, at the end of the month, I'm going to be paying for my usage. So to kind of jump into a visual here, so this is, let's think of this as like an order graph at a company, an e-commerce company, right? So it has some seasonality to it. People are typically not shopping at 2 a.m. on Tuesday unless you're me. And so there's some seasonality throughout the week. They're in the middle of the day, it goes up. And we're probably used to seeing graphs like this, where it just kind of goes up and down and, very predictable. And that's the black line here. That's the actuals here is the black line. And the red dashed line here is predictive. So this is using a very simple algorithm, double exponential smoothing with some bounding on it, to basically give a band of where we think that number should be. If you're curious about predictive algorithms, just go to Wikipedia, search predictive algorithms. There's like 20 of them there. I recommend keeping it as simple as you can. The second you get too complicated with it, it tends to be more wrong than it is right. So try to keep it as simple as you can. Now, because this is SREcon, we're also used to seeing things like this. This wonderful little area down here is what we'll call an outage. And I'm purposely exaggerating here. We typically don't have outages that last an entire day, especially on Wednesdays. It always happens on Fridays for some reason, but we'll say it's on Wednesdays. And what's interesting here is that a lot of businesses actually will use this kind of rubric to figure out, were we available or not? This idea that, well, we were unavailable on basically all of Wednesday, and so for this week, this business week, we're only 80% reliable because 20% of the time we were out of those red dashed lines here. And kind of the rubric that a lot of companies use to figure out whether their service was up and running or not was, hey, were we able to make money? And were we able to accept money from customers, or were we able to at least make money during that time? And one way to get especially your finance team and your exec team to care about this is call out, this is how you lose money. This is literally how this area between the curves here is how much money you just lost on Wednesday. And I just realized I'm being somewhat culturally insensitive given where I am, so it can be euros as well. It doesn't have to be dollars, but what I do encourage folks to think about is this idea that this is a quantifiable way to show the rest of your business, here's how much money you're losing when you are having outages, and you can quantify it. If we had been able to avoid this outage, we could have saved X number of euro or dollars. All right, subscription businesses. This is a little bit harder. One thing that you can't solely do is measure when you make money. So PagerDuty, we're a subscription service. We bill at the end of the month. And you know, I jokingly say, like, gosh, I wish we only had to be available one day out of the month when we're billing our customers. And if we did that, everyone would cancel their service because we've completely lost their trust and they're going to not pay us the next month. So what we had to find was something between how money is made versus something that our customers care about. And this is really hard. We actually spent quite a bit of time on this, and while I keep trying to get us to one number, we actually have two or three that we look at on a weekly basis to figure out what was our reliability and availability that week. And this is the number that we ended up settling on. So at PagerDuty, we call ourselves an incident resolution service. So we look at number of incidents resolved per hour, and this is the seasonality. So this is over the course of July 2017. You can see that there's some dips here. Those are the weekends. Thank you very much for not breaking things on the weekends. It makes my life so much better, and it makes my capacity planning a little bit easier. But you can see here, there's daily and weekly seasonality to this. And what happens is we use basic predictives around this to figure out what it's gonna be on a week over week basis. Even with our substantial business growth, we basically just apply X percentage growth every week and we can predict where this number is going to be. When it goes beyond the bounds, that counts as unavailability or unreliability for us. Of course, I had to strip out the units. Unfortunately, my legal team would not let me disclose some of that data. All right, so finding the right metrics is hard. I don't pretend it's easy. This is something that took me probably months, actually, after I showed up at the company trying to figure out, you know, what's something that our customers care about that I do think will eventually impact our revenue. But it's still worth looking for, because if you don't find that metric, you're going to be in this constant debate of what does it mean to be reliable? What does it mean to be available? And if you can get to that single metric, again, we're not even there yet, but if you can get there, it will make your life so much easier in terms of broadcasting that message of here's what it means to be available and reliable at our company. Next tactic, more people on call. I was at the talk with ING earlier and was kind of excited to hear some of the tactics that they've used on putting their management team and their exec team on call. One thing that I always call out to a lot of our engineers when they're trying to figure out who should go on call for a service is that customers do not care who gets paged. They don't care. They don't care whether it was the NOC, the SRE team, the development team, the team in Dublin, the team in Toronto, and say, they don't care. All they care about is that they just want to use the service. That's it. That's all customers care about. When they go to your website, they hit the buy button, they get a 500, they are not angry at the NOC. They are not angry at the SRE team. They are mad at the company as a whole. They don't care. So, in a centralized operations org, this is, by the way, this is a flame symbol, not hair. I was trying to find like a good symbol for like, oh, something breaking, and thank you, Keynote. Centralized operations org, something breaks, you page the centralized NOC, or whatever you call it in your organization, and then if it warrants it, they'll help dispatch to other folks. One thing I do want to call out here, so there is actually a couple of different people symbols here. So there's the walking symbol. This is the running symbol that I'm doing right here. And what I also loved, I had to flip it because as SREs, we're one of the few folks that actually run towards fires as opposed to away from fires. So thank you again, Keynote, for letting me flip images around so I can show SREs running towards fires. So this is what centralized operations and engineering orgs look like. Again, it's that single function that's responsible for dispatching and responding to events when they come in. Now, when companies move to more of a distributed operations engineering organization, this is kind of what it looks like early on. So in a way, I do support this because you're putting more people on call, but the common mistake that I see a lot of folks make is they take what I'll call a spray and pray approach, which is, well, let's just page everyone. And I kid you not, and I'll get into details later, we actually did this at PagerDuty in our early days, and which is a huge anti-pattern, something I do not recommend. But this is usually the journey that people go through. This is the first step towards making it better in the long run. And what you're still running into is this idea that you're still gonna have these big, giant, hunky, major incidents that page everyone. And then eventually, what you get to is something like this, where you have multiple smaller incidents going directly to either the individual engineering teams, the individual operations teams, SRE teams, whatever it is in your organization. And the idea here is that you actually do have more incidents, but they're much smaller in scale. And so what ends up happening is your service, your business, is actually in a constant state of degradation, but because it's so small, your customers probably don't notice, and therefore you're actually able to create a more resilient, more reliable system because you're constantly introducing failure. Again, this lines up really nicely with like microservice architectures where one small failure in an entire architecture is not gonna take out the entire thing anymore. Again, the point here is that you're having smaller, smaller, and smaller incidents that customers don't notice over time. Now, PagerDuty, we took this a little bit farther. We actually have started putting a lot of our non-technical teams on call as well, things like product management, HR, UX, marketing, exec team. Again, very similar to what we heard earlier from ING. And I want to tell two stories here that really always sticks out to me over my time at PagerDuty, kind of why this is really important to me. The first is we had a recruiting coordinator join our company, Stephanie. This is about 4.5 years ago, and she joins and she's trying to understand what does it mean to go on call? What does it mean to carry the pager? And she didn't really understand this, so I tell her, like, well, do you want to shadow me for a week? So I'm on call for our team, and she's shadowing me, and I think I got paged once or twice in the middle of the night that week. And so we're syncing up at the end of the week. I'm getting some feedback from her. Hey, what do you think? What do you think of the process and whatnot? And there's just this look of shock in her face where she asked me, so when you're on call, do you expect to get 8 hours of sleep? And unfortunately, I said no. Like, that's unfortunately part of the really hard part of being on call. And to be clear, I'm not advocating that this is okay. It's not. If you can set up follow the sun teams, if you can set up teams where you're not getting woken up in the middle of the night, please do so. I don't want to idolize getting woken up in the middle of the night at all. But it was incredibly interesting that she had never experienced that in her entire life. She didn't understand this concept that you are willingly knowing that when you go to bed at 10 p.m. or whenever you go to bed, that you're not guaranteed 8 hours of sleep or whatever you're trying to get. And so now she had a little bit more empathy for our engineers when they showed up at 10:30, 11 o'clock, maybe they're late for a meeting in the morning. She kind of gets it now because she now went through that experience, and so she realized maybe I shouldn't be so hard on them that they were a few minutes late to that phone screen that I scheduled them for at 10 in the morning. Maybe I should actually look at the on-call calendar, and that's actually what ended up happening. Stephanie would start looking at the on-call calendar when she was scheduling phone screens for our engineers to make sure they weren't on call such that it would make the engineer's life a little bit easier. Another really fun one, somewhat HR-related, about 7-8 months ago, one of our sales reps had set up a demo account with what we thought at the time was employee information, and thankfully it wasn't. You know, it turned out to be a non-event, but one thing that we had to figure out from a security side was, were we in violation of any employee privacy laws here? And so immediately we had to get a hold of our HR and our legal teams, and it was an absolute nightmare because they weren't on call, and so I'm calling people at like 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night, people are unresponsive, I'm having to get a hold of lawyers, and they're getting mad at me because it's after 5. Absolute mess. And so as we were going through the postmortem on this, we realized that, you know, we needed some ability to be able to get a hold of our HR teams even after hours. And again, they're not getting paged constantly or anything, but our HR team willingly signed up to go on call to make that easier for the rest of our teams at the company. In fact, now our HR team is on call to support things like employee emergencies or if someone's having an issue while they're traveling and, you know, they can't get across the border or something like that, they can actually page our HR team to get employee support. And that's one of the ways that our HR team is able to provide a better service to the rest of the organization. And for me, like with these kinds of stories and these kinds of experiences, it's really weird when you have your HR team advocating for building more reliable software because that preserves the mental health of your engineers. It's really weird when that happens, but it's really awesome because it goes beyond this idea of reliability being just about protecting revenue. All of a sudden, reliability is something that your entire company starts to care about because it starts to impact things like employee health. It starts to impact things like the services that HR teams can provide to the rest of an organization. So a little summary here. So distributed operations organizations, not just engineering, from my perspective, it sets expectations around availability of people. I really like this because it encourages this idea of, yes, there's going to be interruptions, but we can at least isolate to a single individual on the team. It encourages more small incidents versus single large incidents. And it builds empathy around why reliability is hard. All of a sudden, when a marketing team is on call and they're not responding quickly enough, and their manager sees that, they understand that, oh, maybe we need to make sure our marketing team has wireless devices such that they can connect remotely. Maybe we need to set it up such that our UX team can easily get into the VPN easily because they want to respond to an issue. But it starts to build that kind of trust and that empathy across teams because now everyone's dealing with some sort of reliability challenge within their team and department. Tooling and processes. So, you know, I have this firm belief as an industry we're pretty bad at, we think about silver bullets too much. And, you know, I'm pretty sure I said this at some point early in my career. And thankfully I'll let people read that. Thankfully I've wisened up a little bit in the last 15 years that I don't believe in silver bullets anymore. I think a better way that I think about tooling and processes now is something that Jeff Bezos said a few years back, this idea that we humans, we co-evolve with our tools, we change the tools change us, and the cycle repeats. Think about how many times as SREs where you've introduced some sort of new process or some new tool into your organization, 6 months go by, and then your customers come back to you and say, well, what have you done for me lately? That's the people evolving because the tool evolved. It pulled the people a little bit forward, and then the people caught up with the tool, the people moved a little bit forward, and now the tooling has to catch up with the people again. And it's this wonderful escalation race between the two. And I'm gonna walk through some of the tooling and processes that we've set up at PagerDuty and kind of how they've evolved over time and kind of this idea of how the tooling and processes change as long as how the people change with it as well. So the first one is Failure Friday, and I'll call this a process. I've talked about Failure Friday in a couple other talks, and we have actually a lot of good blog posts on this, so I won't go into too many details of what it is. But Failure Friday, it's a process that we have where once a week we get our engineers into a room. It started about 4.5 years ago. We get them together for an hour, and we just break stuff. It's heavily inspired by the Netflix Simian Army and other chaos engineering principles. And it's the idea that we want to get people and the teams together and share those learnings about things breaking together and, of course, fixing them quickly. So it started really small. It started literally as just a calendar invite. We didn't even have an agenda for the first one. I then got yelled at, and then I had set up a second one with a proper agenda. And it started super small. We invited our entire engineering staff. This is when we were around 15 engineers, 1 hour every Friday, and that was it. And this is how it started. So this is me adding some latency to our Cassandra cluster. My colleague John saying, yep, you know, there's some latency, and acknowledging that our Cassandra cluster is running a bit slower, and we're just watching it. We were just looking at metrics, trying to see what the customer impact was, and learning about the failure that we just introduced. You can also tell how old the slide is, because we're still using HipChat back then. is it Atlassian sponsoring? Sorry. Don't worry, we use Jira. But this was what worked for us 4.5 years ago. This was great for a 15-person engineering org. Now we're a little over 100. And so we had to get a little bit bigger and smarter about it. So we had to add in automation. About 18 months ago, one of our engineers, Donnie Nadalny, he added Chaos Cat. Again, we just stole the terminology from Netflix here. And if you're wondering what's going on here, I'll walk you through it. So this is two bots talking to each other. So the first is Chaos Cat's asking, hey, what's the status of PagerDuty? Then our other bot is saying, everything's good. And you know, go ahead, Chaos Cat, do what you want. All right, I'm gonna randomly add some latency to some random production server. And if you're curious, this is exactly how Skynet and Terminator get started. It's bots talking to each other. I apologize in advance for introducing the apocalypse. But what's really interesting here is that, you know, we add this automation, and all it was doing was automating what we were already doing manually. And it was very simple, but it still took us 2 years to even introduce this automation. And it wasn't because we didn't want to automate, say, 3 years ago, but we just didn't have the processes down well enough. So then we introduced the automation, and of course, things evolved. And then we introduced another tool called Reboot Roulette. Again, this is this idea of we had this process and tooling, we added some automation to it, and then the engineers started using it a little bit more, and this other idea came out where, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could just randomly reboot servers? And so this is Ka. When we don't have a specific service to reboot, we just nominate one of our engineers, and he'll type bang FF, Failure Friday, reboot roulette production. It just goes and reboots a host for us. And again, knock on wood, nothing happens. But if something does, we're doing it in the middle of the day together, and we can fix it faster than customers will ever notice it. Again, this is a great example of the tooling evolving, the people evolving, and how there's this constant escalation race. It was manual, it was a manual process, we did that for a while, and then we automated it, the people caught up, then we had to update the tooling to reflect that the people had caught up to it. And the next step in this is probably just shutting down servers, probably being much more aggressive around shutting down entire data centers as well. Major incident response. Again, this is an interesting example of that evolution around process and tooling. Believe it or not, we actually started really poorly with our internal incident response process at PagerDuty. We were like shockingly bad at this a couple years ago. I'll give you an example, like I was talking about earlier. We used to page the entire engineering staff when we were about 12, 15 people, when there was a single 500. A single 500 would page 12 to 15 people. And then, of course, everyone's tired in the morning and no one's effective the next day. And as much as I love that intent, as much as I love and admire the effort and that ownership that all of our engineers had, it doesn't scale. It doesn't make sense to have everyone be tired the next day for a single 500. So we got a little bit better each time. We started to spread that ownership of who owns what during major incident response, making sure that there were clear expectations around, you know, who owns what system, who owns what alerts, things like that. And again, it was a gradual process. It didn't happen overnight. It took us about 6 months to get from that single 500 paging everyone to even having more isolated, more finely tuned alerting on a per team basis. So then we introduced some new tooling around this as well. So we have this concept called an incident commander at PagerDuty. At other companies, it can be called call leader, engineering crisis manager, things like there's many different terms for this. But really, this is the one person that's responsible for making sure that incidents get resolved faster and moving the call forward. And so we introduced some basic chatbot tooling where this single command here, bang IC page, will actually page the incident commander immediately. And we've made this as low friction as possible because we want anyone to be able to exercise this. We've had interns at the company that were unsure of, hey, is this a major incident? I don't know. You know what? I'm going to play it safe. You know, bang, I see page, and it just pages, and we kick off the process. We've even had folks on the non-technical side that were worried about something happening. There was a physical security issue in one of our offices, and they used the same exact process. Again, we're trying to make this as accessible for everyone at the company. So when I think about that kind of culture bit around reliability, it gets everyone into that mindset that if there is a problem, I immediately have an escalation path that I can take. And we've made it as easy as possible for any employee at the company to be able to kick off this process. And a lot of the pushback that I've gotten from a lot of colleagues and even folks within the company is, what if someone abuses this? What if someone, you know, plays a prank or something like that? Which, when I'm on call, some of my directs do that. But that's okay. But we've been running this for about a year now, and in that time, out of dozens of times when this has been triggered, only once was it done incorrectly, and it was done because someone was playing around with it. They were incredibly apologetic, and quite frankly, they then had to exercise this tooling about 6 months later, and I was quite happy because they were now familiar with it, and they didn't shy away from it. So this idea that you need hard controls around everything to encourage reliability, I don't buy that. I think that's a fallacy, that you can trust your employees, you can trust your engineers to behave the right way if you have that culture around reliability, and this kind of tooling will not get abused. Like I said, it's all still a work in progress. We're not perfect. Even this past Tuesday, we had an event that we were managing internally, and one of our engineers brought up a great set of feedback on our internal incident response processes, and we've documented this, and we've even open sourced this. About 7 months ago, Rich Adams, one of the engineers on our teams, open sourced our incident response documentation internally, and it's on response.pagerdy.com. It's on GitHub. Fork it, make it your own. We encourage you to file PRs against this one if you think we should update it. We're going to be updating it because, like I said, on Tuesday we had an issue, and we're going to be updating our own response documentation to support the feedback that we got from that engineer. So if you do have feedback on that, again, please go to GitHub and file those PRs. Another example of a process change that we did as a reaction and kind of updating our processes was we introduced this concept of what we call an internal liaison role. So I'll do a quick tour of history. So back in October, we had a major incident. And while we're communicating with customers, one of the problems that we had during the postmortem that our exec team called out was they were frustrated because they were getting updates at the same rate that our customers were. So while it's good that we were updating customers frequently on a regular cadence, our exec team was frustrated because they didn't have the full context such that if customers were reaching out to them directly, they were constantly having to say, I'll get back to you, I'll get back to you. Instead, they wanted more information. So what we did was we introduced this concept called an internal liaison to basically make sure that there's over-communication happening during major incidents. It combats a lot of that kind of skepticism around what's going on, are they doing the right things, and kind of gets your executive team to be a little bit more hands-off during major incidents. The other thing that it does is it keeps the entire company on the same page with regards to reliability challenges. This is something we leverage quite a bit in just educating our own internal stakeholders on, hey, reliability is really hard. By the way, here's an example of us internally communicating that there's a problem right now. And this was something where our service discovery framework, we thought there was a problem, so our alerting went off. And really all it is you know, our customer success manager, Dimitri here, he was acting as the internal liaison here. This wasn't like a new job or anything. It's a role that we assigned to him. He updates, hey, there's been an issue, degraded service. We've recovered from it. And then about, you know, 5 minutes later, we realized, you know what, there wasn't actually any customer impact, but the SRE team is going to dig in a little bit more to make sure and figure out how do we not over alert on this in the future. Again, this is a channel that has almost everyone in the company there. Everyone in the company sees the at here mentions here, and they're getting that context, they're getting that empathy around, oh, reliability's hard. And in order to maintain a service that runs 24/7, that's hard too. And this is how you can educate other stakeholders across the entire company why it's hard. So for me, at least, improving reliability means constantly failing, constantly recovering, and constantly learning. It's a journey. It's not static. You're never done. If there's one thing that I took away, especially from the Google SRE book, was this idea that you're never done with reliability. It's something that just keeps flowing, keeps going, because you need to keep managing it, and you have to keep trying to get better at it constantly. You have to keep taking risks. You have to keep failing. You have to keep learning, and that's how you get better. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here. I know it's exhausting. I don't pretend for a second this stuff is easy. I don't pretend for a second even all the stuff that I'm talking about here, any of this stuff is easy. But we all know this is worth it. We all know that there's the financials around it that can justify it. We know that these are things that we in this room care about, that are near and dear to our hearts, that we care about and want to improve, hence why it's worth it. I'll also say that improving culture means constantly failing, constantly recovering, and constantly learning. Again, this is hard. Culture is one of the hardest things to influence at a company. If you're at a large company and you decide that you want to change the culture, you're signing up for at minimum 12 months of work. Most companies take up to 3 years to turn their cultures either around or, you know, change it 90 degrees. It's really hard work, and it is something that is really, really important. But again, yes, it's exhausting. It's even more exhausting than encouraging reliability practices. But this is the one thing that separates companies that do really well in the long term, is they do care about their cultures, and they do take these things into account, and they are willing to constantly improve it and constantly make it better through their own learnings. Thank you, folks. I want to thank all of you for attending. Thank you to the organizers and the chairs of SREcon. I've had a great time at the conference so far, not just the sessions, but also just interacting with a bunch of you folks here. And also to the city of Dublin. This is my first time in Dublin, so thank you for being such hospitable guests. I'll also end with, we are hiring. If you're interested in building these kinds of cultures and working in that kind of a culture, specifically for SREs and for SRE managers, please get in touch. And that's all I got, folks. Thank you.